myself that if I make a commitment or a promise to myself regarding diet or exercise or anything else, and I don't keep it, I definitely become less sensitive to the needs and feelings of others. I feel more upset and angry with myself, and I can feel integrity lessening. It's not until I go back, recommit, make up my mind, and then keep my promises that I can basically forget myself and genuinely empathize with other people. What happens to our spirit, to our peace of mind, when we neglect the body? It affects our desire to contribute, to serve, our willingness to sacrifice, to subordinate ourselves for a higher good. Our conscience becomes dulled, yielding to almost any temptation. Any loss of personal integrity makes me more self-oriented, more selfish. However, I find that when I make up my mind to live by principles and by conscience, my resolve to serve and to contribute in meaningful ways returns. Physical self-mastery and development is foundational. It is also very concrete, something we can immediately do something about. We have more direct access to it. We can control it. As we master the body's appetites and strengthen its intelligence, we'll begin to see the space enlarging between stimulus and response, with all of the attending positive mental, emotional, and spiritual spin-offs. I find most people acknowledge they get off the track from time to time. But if they will sincerely listen to the feedback of their body, mind, heart, and spirit, and make the necessary changes, they can get back on the track. It's just like the flight of an airplane. Most airplanes are off track almost the entire time as well. But because the pilot receives constant feedback from various instruments to help him or her get back on the flight path, almost all of flights arrive at the destination they established. A person's conscience, if he will listen to it, will direct him in all three of these areas: exercise, nutrition, rest, and stress management. And the more he follows it, the stronger it becomes, so that he can move more and more toward giving of himself. By eating wisely, exercising, resting, and relaxing, we deepen our capacities and strengthen the body's immune system and ability to rebuild itself. Most importantly, we release the other three intelligences contained in the mind, the heart, and the spirit. Now let's move to developing mental intelligence, what we call IQ. I suggest three ways to develop IQ, or mental capacity. First, systematic, disciplined study and education, including study outside of one's own field. Second, the cultivation of self-awareness, so that one can make assumptions explicit and think outside the box and outside their comfort zone. Third, learning by teaching and by doing. Let's look at each one. First, continuous, systematic, disciplined study and education. People who have made a commitment to continual learning, growth, and improvement are those who have the ability to change, adapt, flex with the changing realities of life, and become fundamentally equipped to produce in any area of life. Our only real economic security lies in our power to meet human needs. So the worse conditions become, the more evident human needs become. Our security does not lie in our organizations or our jobs. Disruptive technologies may simply make them irrelevant. But if we have strong, active, alert, growing, learning minds, we will be able to land on all fours. The concept that mental IQ is a fixed commodity has long since been disproved. The more the mind is used, the stronger it becomes. The more responsive the mind is to the conscience, the wiser it becomes. I strongly believe that we should turn the TV way down in our lives and get back to reading. Reading broadly, deeply, outside our comfort zones and outside our professional fields. For instance, among other magazines, I like to read Scientific American, The Economist, Psychology Today, Harvard Business Review, Fortune, Business Week, U.S. News and World Report. My wife constantly encourages me to read more fiction, biographies, and autobiographies, which are her main interests. I think she counsels wisely. I am also sent many books for endorsement purposes, and I have learned to read conceptually by studying the table of contents and learning the style of the writer in order to discover where the main ideas are expressed or summarized. In this way, I can capture the essence of many books in a day or so, or even an hour or so. Another very interesting and helpful learning style I have found is to break down the presentations you hear or the books you read into four areas. First, purpose. Second, main points. Third, validation, in other words, evidence. Fourth, application, in other words, examples and stories. I have found that by training your mind to think in this way while you listen or read, it is amazing how well and accurately you can capture and understand the material, almost to the point of being able to make the presentation that you had just listened to as if you had spent many times that time acquiring such understanding. Purpose, main points, validation, application. Fundamentally, everyone has to decide for himself or herself the best way to maintain continued education. In a knowledge worker age, it is so vital. People have to look carefully at where they are spending their time and how much time they are wasting, then become very mentally disciplined. The page pays huge dividends. Most people say that because they are so busy, they don't have much time for reading, or even time for their children. The evidence is overwhelming, however, that people spend about half their time doing urgent things that are not important. But the more disciplined a person becomes about focusing on the vitally important things, the more he or she has a strong feeling of yes burning inside his or her heart. It's very easy then to say smilingly, happily, and cheerfully, no, to all of the many distractions, however urgent they may become. Next heading, cultivation of self-awareness, or making assumptions explicit. Self-awareness involves all four intelligences and is a unique human endowment. It's essentially another word for the space between stimulus and response, the space where you can pause and then make choices or decisions. Cultivating self-awareness by trying to understand and make explicit our underlying assumptions, theories, and paradigms is, without any question, one of the highest leverage activities we can be involved in. Because we are always making assumptions, and because they are very implicit, that is, we are unaware we are making them, by making them explicit, by questioning them, we can make huge quantum leaps. We can simply learn to think what's called outside the box. Self-awareness involves all four intelligences and is a unique human endowment. It's essentially another word for the space between stimulus and response, the space where you can pause and then make a choice or decision. Let me suggest several other approaches to nurture self-awareness. My daughter Colleen probably has 70 different journals filled with her thoughts written for her eyes only. Journal writing has enabled her to be an observer of her own involvements in life, and also to make choices based on those observations. She has developed the capacity to reinvent herself almost on a moment's notice, simply because her self-awareness is so deep and strong. I have seen her make important decisions based on the direction of conscience or spiritual intelligence, subordinating both IQ and EQ, and then later finding all three to be in harmony. The discipline of putting thoughts into writing is grueling, but powerful and clarifying. A failure learned from becomes a success. So in this sense, there need be no real failures, only learning experiences put to good use in life. Another powerful way to develop awareness of self and others, and to make assumptions explicit, is seeking feedback from other people. We all have blind spots. Some of them are literally crippling to our effectiveness, but if we will cultivate the habit, either informally or formally, of seeking feedback from other people, people we care about and around whom we work and live, we will fast-track our growth and development. It's analogous to people doing market research and benchmarking against world-class excellence, rather than local or regional competitors. This often gives us information on blind spots that are also blind to other people. Many people, myself included, see sincere prayer, pondering prayer, listening prayer, as a way to sense the direction of conscience and to see life as a mission, a stewardship, and contribution opportunity. Prayer can also give strength and courage to step back, admit mistakes to others, apologize, recommit, and then get back on track. New heading, learning by teaching and doing. If you remember in chapter 3, we learned that almost everyone acknowledges that we learn best when we teach another, and that it also internalizes our learning when we live it, when we apply it. To know and not to do is really not to know. To learn and not to do is not to learn. In other words, to understand something but not to apply it is really not to understand it. It is in the doing, the applying, that knowledge and understanding are internalized. New heading, neglecting the development of the mind. We live in a world of compounding complexity and digital speed. Markets and technology are becoming globalized. A new kind of terrorism, one with potentially worldwide devastating consequences, is creating fear in most every heart. Whole communities are experiencing confusion and vertigo in values. Families are being stressed as never before. Our engine to meet these challenges is the mind, the power to think. When it is neglected, the body itself will suffer. As someone put it, if you think education is expensive, just try ignorance. The moral imperative of life is grow or die. The half-life of many professions is just a few years. If we transfer responsibility for our mental development to our employing organization, we become increasingly codependent and may become professionally obsolete. It reduces our capacity to earn. We might lose our jobs. The body deteriorates more rapidly. We die earlier. What is the impact on the heart, on relationships, when we neglect the mind and its constant development? We're governed more and more by ignorance, by prejudice, by stereotyping and labeling. It can lead to very provincial thinking, even narcissism and paranoia. Our whole view of life becomes myopic, narrow, and self-focused. What is the impact on the spirit when we stop learning? The conscience first becomes numbed, then dulled, and finally silenced, because it constantly tells us to learn and to grow. We lose both the sense of vision in life and the struggle to find our voice, both of which are primary sources of our passion in life. We find the wisdom literature boring and uninspiring, even irrelevant. Now let's move to the subject of developing emotional intelligence, EQ. Interestingly, if you carefully study the emotional intelligence literature, it suggests first the transcendent importance of EQ in long-term effectiveness, and second, that EQ can be developed. But interestingly, there is relatively little out there on how it can be developed. The five commonly accepted primary components of emotional intelligence are first, self-awareness, the ability to reflect on one's own life, grow in self-knowledge, and use that knowledge to improve oneself and either overcome or compensate for weaknesses. Second, personal motivation, which deals with what really excites people, the vision, values, goals, hopes, desires, and passions that make up their priorities. Third, self-regulation, or the ability to manage oneself toward achieving one's vision and values. Fourth, empathy, the ability to see how other people see and feel about things. And fifth, social and communication skills, which deal with how people resolve differences, solve problems, produce creative solutions, and interact optimally to further their joint purposes. I have become deeply convinced that the best systematic way to develop these five dimensions of EQ is through the 7 habits of highly effective people. Let me illustrate. Take the first component of EQ, or emotional intelligence, called self-awareness. An awareness of self, of our freedom and power to choose, is the heart of habit 1, be proactive. In other words, you are aware of the space between stimulus and response. You're aware of your genetic, biological inheritance, your upbringing, and of the environmental forces around you. But unlike animals, You can make wise choices regarding these things. You sense that you are or can become the creative force of your own life. This is your most fundamental decision. Next component of EQ, personal motivation. Personal motivation is the basis of those choices. That is, you decide what your highest priorities, goals, and values are. That's essentially what Habit 2 is about. Begin with the end in mind. This decision to direct your own life is your primary decision. The third component, self-regulation, is another way of expressing put first things first, which is Habit 3, and sharpen the saw, Habit 7. In other words, once you decide what your priorities are, then you live by them. It is the habit of integrity, the habit of self-mastery, of doing what you intend to do, of living by your values. Then constantly renew yourself. Execution strategies and tactical decisions are your secondary decisions. So Habit 1, fundamental. Habit 2, primary. Habit 3, secondary. The fourth component of EQ is called empathy. Empathy is the first half of Habit 5, seek first to understand, then to be understood. It's learning to transcend your own autobiography and get into the head and hearts of other people. It's becoming socially very sensitive and aware of the situation before attempting to be understood, influence others, or make decisions or judgments. The fifth and last component of EQ that is widely accepted is called social communication skills. The combination of Habits 4, 5, and 6 represent social communication skills. In other words, you think in terms of mutual benefit and mutual respect. That's Habit 4, think win-win. Then you strive for mutual understanding. That's Habit 5, seek first to understand, then to be understood. In order to have creative cooperation, that's Habit 6, called synergize. I acknowledge again that I have made connections between the seven habits and the development of these five dimensions of emotional intelligence in a summary fashion only. If you have a sincere and serious interest in developing greater EQ, I commend to you a sincere study and effort to apply the principles contained in the seven habits of highly effective people. I do so without any desire to promote my own work, but rather with the conviction of the power of the universal, timeless, self-evident principles it contains. Principles I cannot and do not take credit for they belong to all humanity and are present in every nation, society, religion, or community that has endured and prospered. New heading, Neglecting Emotional Intelligence. Authors Doc Childre and Bruce Cryer describe the impact that ignoring the intelligent voice of the heart has on the body. Here's the way they put it. Intelligence capacity is diminished when frustration, anxiety, or inner turmoil operate. Such emotional states cause incoherence in the rhythmic and electrical output of the heart, diminishing neurological efficiency. It's one of the reasons smart people can do stupid things. When you make internal coherence a daily priority, you save time and energy. Then they continue to explain, our immune system is weakened when we act counter to our deeper values and conscience, which grows in strength when we feel and express heartfelt love or care. The Heart Math Organization has scientifically demonstrated this connection, both at the level of personal immunity. Did you ever become sick after a major argument? Or upon hearing a key initiative you worked for months has been canceled? And even at the organizational level, which they refer to as an emotional virus, sapping the organizational spirit, vitality, and morale. Close quote. If we neglect developing our emotional intelligence by failing in our self-discipline to win the private victories that lead to public victories, we will experience emotional traumas, stresses, and such negative and disruptive emotions as anger, envy, covetousness, jealousy, and irrational guilt. When a core relationship is stressed, broken, or violated, it impacts the body and weakens the immune system. People experience headaches and psychosomatic illnesses of many kinds. Their minds often become depressed, unfocused, and distracted, and they lose the ability to think abstractly, carefully, analytically, and creatively. The spirit also becomes depressed and discouraged. People often begin feeling helpless, hopeless, victimized, and sometimes so despairing that they become suicidal. That is why it is so important to constantly nourish relationships with other people and with ourselves. Now let's look at how we develop spiritual intelligence, SQ. I suggest three ways to develop spiritual intelligence. First, integrity. That is, being true to one's highest values, convictions, and conscience, and having a connection with the infinite. Second, meaning. Having a sense of contribution to people and to causes. And third, voice. Aligning our work with our unique talents or gifts and our sense of calling. Let's look at each one in turn. Integrity, making and keeping promises. The best way to develop integrity, I suggest, is to start very small and to make and keep a promise. Make a promise that may seem so small, so insignificant to others, but to you represents a sincere effort, such as exercising for 10 minutes, not eating that dessert, watching one less hour of television a day, and instead reading one chapter of a book, expressing thanks in a letter to someone, expressing thanks in person, praying daily, asking forgiveness, or reading sacred literature for 10 minutes a day. The point is that when you make a promise and keep it, your capacity to make and keep a larger promise increases. Continue to do this, and soon your sense of honor will become stronger than your moods. You will develop personal integrity, meaning you are integrated, which will become a great source of power to you. This is truly igniting a small fire until it becomes a large fire within. Now let's look at the other dimension of integrity, educating and obeying our conscience. Perhaps the most compelling way to develop spiritual intelligence is to educate and obey our conscience. Madame de Stael puts it this way: the voice of conscience is so delicate that it is easy to stifle, but it is also so clear that it is impossible to mistake. Close quote. As you begin to study the wisdom literature of your own tradition, or as you sense the lives of people who have inspired and lifted yours, you'll sense the voice of conscience guiding and directing you. It's a still, small voice. And what C.S. Lewis says will literally come to pass. The more you obey your conscience, the more your conscience demands of you. Close quote. It not only makes demands upon you, but it also enlarges your capacities, your intelligences, and your contributions. Your talents double when you wisely use those given you. Now let's look at the other two components of spiritual intelligence: finding meaning and finding your voice. This subject, of course, is the main thrust of this book and overlaps everything else. But one simple way to find one's voice, as mentioned before, is to simply ask the question, what does my life situation ask of me now? What should I do in my present responsibilities, duties, stewardships? What would be the wise action to take? When we live true to the answers our conscience gives, the space becomes larger and the conscience louder. Another very significant way of finding your sense of voice or calling is when you are selecting a career, job, or a cause to give yourself to. Remember to ask fundamental questions representing the four intelligences: body, mind, heart, and spirit. What do I really like doing I do well? Should I do it? Can I make a living at it? Can I learn to get better at it? Do I want to pay the price of learning? Jim Collins, in his compelling book, Good to Great, encourages people as well as organizations to ask the question, what can I be best in the world at? I know at least one correct answer to this question that applies to all of us who are parents. If we make up our minds, we can be best in the world at raising our own children. No one cares like we do. Someone anonymously once said, 100 years from now, it will not matter what kind of car I drove, what kind of house I lived in, how much money I had in my bank account, nor what my clothes looked like. But the world may be a little better because I was important in the life of a child. New heading. What happens when we neglect, ignore, or violate our spiritual intelligence? What happens to the body when our conscience and our integrity are violated? You can usually see it in the countenances of people, in their eyes. Usually they neglect their bodies. They are often burned out if they're not already worn out. Their minds are usually full of rationalization, which really means telling oneself rational lies. They feel guilty, which is a very healthy emotion when there is a genuine violation of integrity and conscience. They lack peace. They have impaired judgment. The University of California at Berkeley summarized some of their research in a newsletter with this expression, doing well by doing good. What happens to the heart? Those same people lose control over their emotions, their ability to understand others, to empathize with others. Their ability to have compassion and love for others is significantly diminished. C.S. Lewis once said, "When a man is getting better, he understands more and more clearly the evil that is still left in him. When a man is getting worse, he understands his own badness less and less. A moderately bad man knows that he is not very good. A thoroughly bad man thinks he is all right." This is common sense, really. You understand sleep when you are awake, not while you are sleeping. You can see mistakes in arithmetic when your mind is working properly. While you are making them, you cannot see them. Good people know about both bad and evil. Bad people do not know about either. Chapter 5. Express your voice. Vision, discipline, passion, and conscience. When you study the lives of all great achievers, those who have had the greatest influence on others, those who have made significant contributions, those who have simply made things happen, you will find a very similar pattern. Through their persistent efforts and inner struggle, they have greatly expanded their four native human intelligences or capacities. The highest manifestations of these four intelligences are these. For the mind, vision. For the body, discipline. For the emotions, passion. For the spirit, conscience. These manifestations also represent our highest means of expressing our voice. Let's look at each in turn. Vision is seeing with the mind's eye what is possible in people, in projects, in causes, and in enterprises. Vision results when our mind joins need with possibility. As William Blake once said, "What is now proved was once only imagined." When people have no vision, when they neglect the development of the mind's capacity to create, they fall prey to the human tendency toward victimism. Discipline is paying the price to bring that vision into reality. It's dealing with the hard, pragmatic, brutal facts of reality and doing what it takes to make things happen. Discipline arises when vision joins with commitment. The opposite of discipline and the commitment that inspires sacrifice is indulgence, sacrificing what matters most in life for the pleasure or thrill of the moment. Passion is the fire, the desire, the strength of conviction, and the drive that sustains the discipline to achieve the vision. Passion arises when human need overlaps unique human talent. When one does not have the passion, that flows from finding and using one's voice to serve great purposes. The void is filled with insecurity and the empty chatter of a thousand voices that drive the social mirror. In relationship and organizational settings, passion includes compassion. Conscience is the inward moral sense of what is right and what is wrong, the drive toward meaning and contribution and integrity. It is the guiding force to vision, discipline, and passion. It stands in stark contrast to the life dominated by ego. Susanna Wesley, John Wesley's mother, counseled, "Whatever weakens your reason impairs the tenderness of your conscience, obscures your sense of God, takes off your relish for spiritual things. Whatever increases the authority of the body over the mind, that thing is sin to you, however innocent it may seem in itself." Close quote. These four words, vision, discipline, passion, and conscience, essentially embody many, many other characteristics used to describe those traits we associate with people whose influence is great, whether known to many or few. Most differences in the words we use to describe people that we admire, whether in the home or the community or the business or the government, are simply a matter of semantics. New heading. Vision, discipline, and passion rule the world. Any individual who has had a profound influence on others, on institutions, or on society, any parents whose influence has been intergenerational, anyone who has really made a difference for good or ill, possess three common attributes: vision, discipline, and passion. I suggest that these three attributes have ruled the world from its beginning. They represent leadership that works. Consider just a few notable leaders from modern history. George Washington had a vision of building a new nation, united and free from foreign interference. He disciplined himself to learn how to recruit, supply, and keep people from deserting the Revolutionary Army. Angered by discrimination against colonial military officers, British land policies, and restriction on U.S. expansion, Washington was passionate about the cause of liberty. Florence Nightingale, the founder of modern nursing, worked her entire adult life to improve the quality of nursing in military hospitals. Her vision and passion overcame her personal reticence. Mohandas K. Gandhi was instrumental in establishing India as an independent state, though he never held an elected or appointed office. He held no formal position from which to lead people. Gandhi's moral authority created such strong social and cultural norms that it ultimately shaped political will. He governed his life by an awareness of a universal conscience that resided within the people, the international community, and the British themselves. Margaret Thatcher was the first female leader of a great industrial nation. She served three terms as Prime Minister of Great Britain, the longest continuous premiership in the 20th century. Her critics are not few, but she was passionate about urging people to assume the discipline of personal responsibility and to build self-reliance, and she was passionate about bolstering free enterprise in her country. During her tenure in British politics, she helped lift Britain out of economic recession. Nelson Mandela, former president of South Africa, spent almost 27 years in prison for fighting against the apartheid regime. Mandela was impelled by his imagination rather than his memory. He could envision a world far beyond the confines of his experience and memory, which included imprisonment, injustice, tribal warfare, and disunity. Deep within his soul resonated a belief in the worth of every South African citizen. Mother Teresa dedicated herself wholeheartedly, freely, and unconditionally to the service of the poor. She bequeathed her highly disciplined upholding of the vows of poverty, purity, and obedience upon her organization, which has both grown and strengthened ever since her passing. Her famous success formula reads like this: The fruit of silence is prayer. The fruit of prayer is faith. The fruit of faith is love. The fruit of love is service. The fruit of service is peace. Now you'll remember that I mentioned that anyone who has really made a difference for good or ill in the world possessed three common attributes: vision, discipline, and passion. Now consider another leader who possessed all three, but produced shockingly different results. Adolf Hitler passionately communicated his vision of a 1,000-year reign of the Third Reich and of a superior Aryan race. He built one of the most disciplined military-industrial machines the world has ever seen, and he evidenced brilliant emotional intelligence in his impassioned oratory, inspiring in the masses almost fanatical dedication and fear, which he channeled into hate and destruction. There is, however, a huge difference between leadership that works and leadership that endures. Every one of the aforementioned leaders laid a foundation and provided a contribution that endured, except for one. Adolf Hitler, who once said, "Once I am really in power, my first and foremost task will be the annihilation of the Jews." When conscience governs vision, discipline, and passion, leadership endures and changes the world for good. In other words, moral authority makes formal authority work and endure. When conscience does not govern vision, discipline, and passion, leadership does not endure, nor do the institutions created by that leadership endure. In other words, formal authority without moral authority ultimately fails. When we say that when conscience governs vision, discipline, and passion, leadership endures and changes the world for good means that it lifts and also that it lasts. Hitler had vision, discipline, and passion, but was driven by ego. Lack of conscience was his downfall. Gandhi's vision, discipline, and passion were driven by conscience, and he became a servant to the cause and to the people. Again, he only had moral authority, no formal authority, and he was the father and founder of the second largest country in the world and the largest democracy. When vision, discipline, and passion are governed by formal authority void of conscience or moral authority, it also changes the world, but not for good. Rather for evil. Instead of lifting, it destroys. Rather than lasting, it is eventually extinguished. Let's take a closer look at each of these four attributes: vision, discipline, passion, and conscience. They represent basically mind, body, heart, and spirit. Vision. Vision is seeing a future state with the mind's eye. Vision is applied imagination. You see, all things were created twice. First, a mental creation. Second, a physical creation. The first creation is vision. It's the beginning of the process of reinventing oneself or of an organization reinventing itself. It represents desire, dreams, hopes, goals, and plans. But these dreams or visions are not just fantasies. They are reality not yet brought into the physical sphere, like the blueprint of a house before it's built, or the musical notes in a score just waiting to be played. Most of us don't envision or realize our own potential. William James said, "Most people live in a very restricted circle of their potential being. We all have reservoirs of energy and genius to draw upon of which we do not even dream." Close quote. Each of us has immeasurable power and capacity to reinvent our lives. In the following story, notice how one grief-stricken woman was able to create a new vision of her life. Listen to her story. "I was 46 years old when my husband Gordon was diagnosed with cancer. Without hesitation, I took early retirement to be with him. Although his death 18 months later was expected, my grief consumed me. I sorrowed over our dreams unfulfilled. I was only 48 and had no reason to live. My overarching question through my sorrow was, why did God take Gordon and not me? I felt Gordon had so much more to offer the world than I had. With my body, mind, and spirit fatigued beyond measure, I was motivated to find a new meaning in my life. I grabbed onto the idea that all things are created twice, first mentally and then physically. I had to ask myself what talents I had. An aptitude assessment test clarified for me what my strongest abilities were. To create a sense of balance in my life, I focused on the four parts of my nature. On an intellectual level, I realized that I loved to teach. Spiritually and socially, I wanted to continue to support the racial harmony we had endeavored to create in our biracial marriage. Emotionally, I knew I needed to give love. When my mother was alive, she would rock critically ill babies in the hospital. I wanted to give comfort as she had and continue her legacy of unconditional love. I was afraid to fail, but I told myself it would be okay to try different things, like trying on hats. If I didn't like teaching after a semester, I didn't have to go back. I began by going to graduate school so that I could teach on the college level. Graduate school is hard, but at age 48, it was especially tough. I was so used to passing documents off to my secretary to type, it took me a semester just to learn how to type my own papers. Turning off the TV and returning the cable box were acts of sheer will. I completed graduate school and began teaching at a historically black college in Little Rock, Arkansas. I was appointed by the governor to serve on the Martin Luther King Commission to improve racial relations. I rocked crack babies and AIDS infants who are hooked up to ventilators for however short a period of time they have. I know I'm giving comfort, and that gives me a sense of peace. Now my life is good. I can feel Gordon smiling at me. He told me time and time again before he died that he wanted me to have a life full of laughter, happy memories, and good things. How could I waste my life with that directive on my conscience? I don't think I could. I have an obligation to live my life the best I can for the people I love the most, whether they are here or on the other side. Close quote. Albert Einstein said, imagination is more important than knowledge. You see, memory is past. It is finite. Vision is future. It is infinite. Vision is greater than history, greater than baggage, greater than the emotional scars of the past. When someone asked Einstein what question he would ask God if he could ask one, he replied, "How did the universe start?" Because everything after that is just math. And then after thinking for a while, he changed his mind. He said, "Instead I would ask, why was the universe created? Because then I would know the meaning of my own life." Perhaps the most important vision of all is to develop a sense of self, a sense of your own destiny, a sense of your unique mission and role in life, a sense of purpose and meaning. When testing your own personal vision, first ask yourself, does the vision tap into my voice, my energy, my unique talent? Does it give me a sense of calling, a cause worthy of my commitment? Acquiring such meaning requires profound personal reflection, asking deep questions, and envisioning. The author, filmmaker, and world-renowned storyteller Sir Lawrence Vanderpost said, "Without vision, we all suffer from an insufficiency of data. We look at life myopically, that is, through our own lens, our own world. Vision enables us to transcend our autobiography, our past, to rise above our memory. This is particularly practical in human relationships and creates a magnanimity of spirit toward others." Close quote. When we talk about vision, it's important to consider not only the vision of what's possible out there, but also the vision of what we see in other people, their unseen potential. Vision is about more than just getting things done, accomplishing some task, achieving something. It is about discovering and expanding our view of others, affirming them, believing in them, and helping them discover and realize the potential within them. In short, helping them find or create their own voice. In many Eastern cultures, people greet others by putting their arms in an inverted V shape at their chest and bowing to the other person. In doing so, they are saying, "I salute the greatness in you," or "I salute the divinity within you." I know another person who, when she encounters a person, says audibly or in her heart, "I love you. What is your name?" Seeing people through the lens of their potential and their best actions, rather than through the lens of their current behavior or weaknesses, generates positive energy and reaches out and embraces others. This affirming action is also one of the keys to rebuilding broken relationships. It is also the key to successful parenting. There is great power in viewing people separately from their behavior, for as we do, we affirm their fundamental unconditional worth. When we perceive and acknowledge the potential of others, it is as if we hold up a mirror to them reflecting the best within them. This affirming vision not only frees them to become their best, but we too are freed from reacting to unwanted behavior. When people behave far below their potential, our affirming attitude and words become, "That's not like you." While on an international trip many years ago, I remember being introduced to a young man about 18 years old. He had had some great challenges in his youth, including drug and alcohol abuse. Though he was turning his life around, as the two of us visited alone, I could tell that he was struggling for a sense of direction and doubted himself. I also discerned that he was a special young man, full of greatness and real potential. It beamed from his countenance and spirit. Before we parted, I looked him right in the eye and told him that I believed that he would be a person of great influence in the world throughout his life, and that he had unusual gifts and potential. Almost 20 years later, he has become one of the most promising, able young men I know, and is a professional of real accomplishment. A friend of mine was recently visiting with him. During their conversation, this young man spontaneously recounted the experience I described above. Of it, he said, "You have no idea how that 1 hour impacted my life. I was told that I was someone with potential that far surpassed what I had ever imagined. That thought caught hold inside me. It has made all of the difference in the world." Cultivating the habit of affirming people, of frequently and sincerely communicating your belief in them, particularly teenagers who are going through what's called the second identity crisis, is supremely important. It's a relatively small investment with incalculable, unbelievable results. Again, remember the incredible effect that has upon us when someone communicates his or her belief in us, that is, in our potential, when we don't believe in ourselves, that comes from our history. Now, after vision comes discipline. Let's explore it in greater depth. Discipline is just as important as vision, though it is second in the chain. Discipline represents the second creation. It's the executing, the making it happen, the sacrifice entailed in doing whatever it takes to realize that vision. Discipline is willpower embodied. Peter Drucker once observed that the first duty of a manager is to define reality. Discipline defines reality and accepts it. It is the willingness to get totally immersed in it rather than deny it. It acknowledges the stubborn, brute facts of things as they are. Dag Hammarskjöld, the Secretary General of the United Nations, once said, "When the morning's freshness has been replaced by the weariness of midday, when the leg muscles quiver under the strain, the climb seems endless, and suddenly nothing will go quite as you wish, it is then that you must not hesitate." And Warren Bennis said, "Leadership is the capacity to translate vision into reality." Without vision and a sense of hope, accepting reality may be depressing or discouraging. Happiness is sometimes defined as the ability to subordinate what you want now for what you want eventually. This personal sacrifice, the process of subordinating today's pleasure for a greater, longer-term good, is exactly what discipline is all about. Most people equate discipline with an absence of freedom. They say shoulds kill spontaneity. There's no freedom in have to. I want to do what I want to do. That's freedom, not duty. In fact, the opposite is true. Only the disciplined are truly free. The undisciplined are slaves to moods, appetites, and passions. Can you play the piano? I can't. I don't have the freedom to play the piano. I never disciplined myself. I preferred playing with my friends to practicing, as my parents and piano teacher wanted me to do. I don't think I ever envisioned myself as a piano player. I never had a sense of what it might mean, the kind of freedom to create magnificent art that might be valuable to myself and to others throughout my entire life. What about the freedom to forgive? Or the freedom to ask forgiveness? What about the freedom to love unconditionally? The freedom to be a light, not a judge. A model, not a critic. Think of the discipline involved in these. Discipline comes from being discipled to a person or a cause. The great educator Horace Mann once said, "In vain do they talk of happiness, who never subdue an impulse in obedience to a principle. He who never sacrificed a present for a future good, or a personal to a general one, can speak of happiness only as the blind speak of color." Close quote. I remember the initial struggle I faced as a 50-year-old university professor in deciding to leave the safe haven and comfort zone of university professorship to set up my own business. If it weren't for the vision of the greater good I might do, we never would have had the discipline to make the sacrifice and begin the self-denying processes of establishing a new business, taking out a second mortgage, and going deeply into debt. We even acquired a new tongue-in-cheek motto, "Happiness is a positive cash flow," and sweated through each payroll for years. We could never have endured this difficult period if we hadn't had the vision of what was possible and the discipline to hang in there. I truly believe that discipline is the trait common to all successful people. I admire the work of insurance executive Albert E. N. Gray, who spent a lifetime trying to discover the common denominator of success. Finally, he came to the simple but profound realization that although hard work, good luck, and astute human relations are all important, the successful person has formed the habit of doing things that failures don't like to do. They don't like doing them either, necessarily, but their dislike is subordinated by the strength of their purpose, their vision. People who lack discipline and who are unable to subordinate and sacrifice simply play at working. In a sense, every workday becomes like a long, masked ball. They spend the day creating smoke screens, emails detailing what they're working on, phone messages reporting on the status of projects, long meetings to discuss how to do things. Mind-numbing work. Generally, people who spend their time making excuses are those who lack focus and discipline. Setbacks are inevitable. Misery is a choice. There are always reasons, never an excuse. Now that we have discussed vision and discipline, let's discuss passion. Passion comes from the heart and is manifest as optimism, excitement, emotional connection, determination. It fires unrelenting drive. Enthusiasm is deeply rooted in the power of choice rather than circumstance. Enthusiasts believe that the best way to predict the future is to create it. In fact, enthusiasm becomes a moral imperative, making the person part of the solution rather than part of the problem of feeling essentially hopeless and helpless. Aristotle said, "Where talents and the needs of the world cross, therein lies your vocation." We could say, "Therein lies your passion, your voice, that which energizes your life and gives you your drive. It is the fuel of the heart of vision and discipline. It keeps you at it when everything else may say quit, When asked by his doctor how many hours a week he spent working, one man replied, "I don't know. How many hours a week do you breathe?" When life, work, play, and love all revolve around the same thing, you've got passion. The key to creating passion in your life is to find your unique talents and your special role and purpose in the world. It is essential to know yourself before you decide what work you want to do. Remember the Greek philosophy? Know thyself. Control thyself. Give thyself. This is exquisitely sequenced and wise. One's talent, one's mission or role in life is usually detected more than it is invented. Author, filmmaker, and world-renowned storyteller Sir Lawrence Vanderpost wrote, "We have to look inwards into ourselves, look into this container which is our soul. Look and listen to it. Until you have listened in to that thing which is dreaming through you, in other words, answered the knock on the door in the dark, you will not be able to lift this moment in time in which we are imprisoned back again into the level where the great act of creation is going on." Close quote. The great contributors in life are those who, though afraid of the knock at the door, still answer it. Courage is the essence of passion and is, as Harold B. Lee once said, the quality of every virtue acting at its highest testing point. There's a common misconception that a person's skill is their talent. Skills, however, are not talents. Talents, on the other hand, require skills. People can have skills and knowledge in areas where their talents do not lie. If they have a job that requires their skills but not their talents, organizations will never tap into their passion or voice. They'll go through the motions, but this will only make them appear to need external supervision and motivation. If you can hire people whose passion intersects with the job, they won't require any supervision at all. Have you ever had such a job that you absolutely loved? What kind of supervision did you need? You see, such people will manage themselves better than anyone could ever manage them. Their fire comes from within, not from without. Their motivation is internal, not external. Just think about the times when you were passionate about a project, something that was so compelling and absorbing that you could hardly think of anything else. Did you need to be managed or supervised? Of course not. The thought of being told when and how to do it would have been insulting. When you can give yourself to work that brings together a need, your talent, and your passion, power will be unlocked. Now let's look at conscience, which is the most significant of these great four capacities, these virtues. George Washington once said, "Labor to keep alive that little spark of celestial fire, conscience." Much has been said from the outset of this book about the singular importance of conscience. There is a mass of evidence that shows that conscience, this moral sense, this inner light, is a universal phenomenon. The spiritual or moral nature of people is also independent of religion or of any particular religious approach, culture, geography, nationality, or race. Yet all of the enduring major religious traditions of the world are unified when it comes to certain basic underlying principles or values. Immanuel Kant said, "I am constantly amazed by two things, the starry heavens above and the moral law within." Conscience is the moral law within. It is the overlapping of moral law and behavior. Many believe, as do I, that it is the voice of God to his children. Others may not share this belief, but recognize that there is an innate sense of fairness and justice, an innate sense of right and wrong, of what is kind and what is unkind, of what contributes and what detracts, of what beautifies and what destroys, of what is true and what is false. Admittedly, culture translates this basic moral sense into different kinds of practices and words. But this translation does not negate the underlying sense of right and wrong. As I work in nations of different religions and different cultures, I have seen this universal conscience revealed time and again. There really is a common sense of values, a sense of fairness, honesty, respect, and contribution that transcends culture, something that is timeless, which transcends the ages and is also self-evident. Again, it is as self-evident as the fact that trust requires trustworthiness. New heading. Conscience and Ego. Conscience is the still small voice within. It is quiet. It is peaceful. Ego is tyrannical, despotic, and dictatorial. Ego focuses on one's own survival, pleasure, and enhancement to the exclusion of others and is selfishly ambitious. It sees relationship in terms of threat or no threat, like little children who classify all people as he's nice or he's mean. Conscience, on the other hand, both democratizes and elevates ego to a larger sense of the group, the whole, the community, the greater good. It sees life in terms of service and contribution, in terms of others' security and fulfillment. Ego works in the face of genuine crisis, but has no discernment in deciding how severe a crisis or threat is. Conscience is filled with discernment and senses the degree of threat. It has a large repertoire of responses. It has the patience and wisdom to decide what to do when. Conscience sees life on a continuum. It is capable of complex adaptation. Ego can't sleep. It micromanages, it disempowers.